"Leave him," I said. "He'll be found and brought to a doctor. It's his best chance, and ours." Surprisingly, she agreed.
"I think it's what he'd want."
She went quickly to his side.
"Sorry we can't take you with us, but I'm certain we'll meet again."
"In the next world," he croaked,
his eyes slitting open.
"In Abaddon."
With those mysterious words and the girl's screams ringing in our ears, the train came to a stop and the doors opened. We weren't clever. We weren't graceful. The moment the train doors slid open, we just ran as fast as we could. The white leapt out of his car and into ours, by which time we had dashed past the screaming girl, over the fainted boy, and on to the platform, where we struggled against a crowd that was streaming onto the train like a school of spawning fish. This station, unlike all the others, was heaving at the seams.
"There!"
I shouted, pulling Emma toward a way out sign that glowed in the distance. I hoped Addison was somewhere at our feet, but so many people were flooding around us that I could hardly see the floor. Luckily, Emma's strength was returning, or a rush of adrenaline was kicking in, because I don't think I could have supported her weight and threaded the human stampede, too. We'd put about 20 feet and 50 people between us and the train when the white burst out of it, shoving commuters and yelling, "I am an officer of the law!" and "Get out of my way!" and "Stop those children!" Either no one could hear him over the echoing din of the station, or no one was paying attention. I looked back to see him gaining, and that's when Emma started tripping people, sweeping her legs left and right as we ran. People shouted and fell into tangles behind us, and when I looked back again, the white was struggling, stepping on legs and backs and getting swats with umbrellas and briefcases in return. Then he stopped, red-faced and frustrated, to unsnap his gun holster. But the gulf of people between us had yawned too wide now, and though I was sure he'd be heartless enough to fire into a crowd, he wasn't stupid enough to. The ensuing panic would have made us even more difficult to catch. The third time I looked back, he was so far behind and swallowed by the crowd that I could hardly see him. Maybe he didn't really care whether he caught us. After all, we were neither a great threat nor much of a prize. Maybe the dog had been right. Compared to an Imbrin, we were hardly worth the trouble. Halfway to the exits, the crowd thinned enough for us to break into an open run, but we'd taken only a few strides when Emma caught me by the sleeve and stopped me.
"Addison!" she cried, spinning to look around. "Where's Addison?"
A moment later, he came scampering out of the thickest part of the crowd, a long piece of white fabric trailing from a spike on his collar.
"You waited for me," he said. "I became entangled in a lady's stocking."
Heads turned at the sound of his voice.
"Come on! We can't stop now!" I said.
Emma plucked the stocking from Addison's collar, and we were off and running again. Before us were an escalator and an elevator. The escalator was working, but very crowded, so I steered us toward the elevator instead. We ran past a lady painted blue from head to toe, and I had to turn and stare even as my legs carried me onward. Her hair was dyed blue, her face caked with blue makeup, and she wore a skin-tight jumpsuit, also blue. She'd only just passed out of sight when I saw someone even more freakish, a man whose head was divided vertically into halves, one bald and burned to a crisp, the other untouched, hair moosed into a dapper wave. If Emma noticed him, she didn't turn to look.
Maybe she was so used to meeting genuine peculiars that peculiar-looking normals hardly registered. But what if they aren't normal? I thought. What if they're peculiars, and instead of the present, we've ended up in some new loop? What if...
Then I saw two boys with glowing swords battling by a wall of vending machines, each saber clash sounding with a thin, plasticky thwack, and reality came into sharp focus. These strange-looking people weren't peculiars. They were nerds. We were very much in the present. 20 feet away, the elevator doors opened. We poured on the speed and hurled ourselves inside, bouncing off the back wall with our hands while Addison tumbled in on tripping legs. I turned just in time to glimpse two things through the closing doors. The white breaking out of the crowd and coming at us in a full run, and back by the tracks where the train was pulling away, the hologast leaping from the roof of the last car to the station ceiling, swinging like a spider from a light fixture by its tongues, its black eyes burning at me. And then the doors closed, and we were gliding gently upward, and someone was saying,
"Where's the fire, mate?"
A middle-aged man stood in the rear corner of the elevator, costumed and sneering. His shirt was torn, his face was cross-hatched with fake cuts, and strapped to the end of one arm, Captain Hook-style, was a blood-stained chainsaw. Emma saw him and took a quick step back.
"Who are you?"
He looked mildly offended.
"Oh, come on."
"If you really want to know where the fire is, don't answer."
She began to raise her hands, but I reached over and stopped her. "He's no one," I said.
"I thought I was making such an obvious choice this year," the man muttered.
He arched an eyebrow and raised his chainsaw a little.
"Name's Ash. You know, Army of Darkness."
"Never heard of either," said Emma. "Who's your Imbrin?"
"My what?"
"He's just doing a character," I tried to explain, but she wasn't hearing me.
"Never mind who you are," she said. "We could use an army, and beggars can't be choosers. Where are the rest of your men?"
The man rolled his eyes.
"LOL. You guys are funny. Everyone's in the convention center, obviously."
"He's wearing a costume," I whispered to Emma. Then to the guy. "She doesn't see a lot of movies."
"A costume?" Emma scrunched her brow. "But he's a grown man."
"So what?" the man said, looking us up and down. "And who are you supposed to be? Walking dorks? League of Extraordinary Dingleberries?" "Peculiar children," said Addison,
whose ego wouldn't allow him to be silent any longer.
"And I am the seventh pup of the seventh pup in a long and illustrious line of..."
The man fainted before Addison could finish, his head knocking against the floor with a clonk that made me wince.
"You've got to stop doing that," Emma said, then grinned despite herself.
"Serves him right," said Addison. "What a rude person. Now quick, nick his wallet."
"No way," I said. "We're not thieves."
Addison snorted.
"I dare say we need it more than he does."
"Why on earth is he dressed like that?" said Emma.
The elevator dinged, and the doors began to slide open. "I think you're about to find out," I said. The elevator doors split open, and like magic, the daylit world spread before us, so bright we had to shield our eyes. I drew a welcome lungful of fresh air as we stepped out onto a swarming sidewalk. There were costumed people everywhere, superheroes in spandex, zombies shambling in heavy makeup, raccoon-eyed anime girls wielding battle axes.
They congregated in unlikely bunches and spilled into a street blocked off to traffic, drawn like moths to a large gray building where a banner proclaimed, "Comic Convention Today." Emma recoiled toward the elevator.
"What is all this?"
Addison peered over his glasses at a green-haired joker touching up his face paint.
"Judging by their attire, it appears to be some sort of religious holiday."
"Something like that," I said, coaxing Emma back onto the sidewalk. "But don't be scared. They're only dressed up normals, and that's what we look like to them, too. We only need to worry about that white." I failed to mention the hollow, hoping we'd baffled it by vanishing into the elevator. "We should find a place to hide until he's gone, then sneak back into the underground."
"No need for that," Addison said, and he trotted into the crowded street, nose twitching.
"Hey!"
Emma called after him.
"Where are you going?"
But he was already circling back.
"Huzzah for fortune!"
he said, wagging his stubby tail.
"My nose tells me our friends were brought out of the underground here, via that escalator. We've gone the right way after all."
"Thank the birds," Emma said.
"Do you think you can follow their trail?" I asked.
"Do I think I can? They don't call me Addison the Astounding for nothing. Why, there isn't an aroma, a redolence, a peculiar eau de toilette I couldn't nose from 100 meters.
Addison was easily distracted by the topic of his own greatness, even when pressing matters were at hand, and his proud, booming voice had a tendency to carry.
"Okay, we get it," I said,
but he steamrolled on, walking now, following his nose.
"I could find a peculiar in a hollow stack, an imbrin in an aviary."
We chased him into the costumed crowd, between the legs of a dwarf on stilts, around a pack of undead princesses, and on a near-collision course with a Pikachu and an Edward Scissorhands, who were waltzing in the street. "Of course our friends were brought this way," I thought. It was perfect camouflage, not only for us, who amidst all this looked downright normal, but also for whites abducting a herd of peculiar children. Even if some of them had dared cry out for help, who would have taken them seriously enough to intervene? People were play-acting all around us, improvising staged fights, growling in monstrous costumes, moaning like zombies. Some strange kids yelling about being kidnapped by people who wanted to steal their souls wouldn't raise an eyebrow. Addison walked a circle, sniffing the ground, then sat down, perplexed. Subtly, because even in this crowd a talking dog would be shocking, I bent down and asked him what was the matter.
"It's just, he stammered, "that I seem to have
lost the trail," Emma said. "I thought your nose was infallible."
"I've merely mislaid the trail. But I don't understand how it leads quite clearly to this spot, then vanishes."
"Tie your shoes," Emma said suddenly. "Now!"
I looked down at them. "But they're not." She grabbed my forearm and yanked me down.
"Tie your shoes,"
she repeated, then mouthed,
"White."
We knelt there, hidden below the heads of the loose-knit crowd. Then came a burst of loud static and a strained voice through a walkie-talkie.
"Code 141. All crews report to the acre immediately."
The white was close. We heard him reply in a gruff, oddly accented voice.
"This is M. I'm tracking the escapees. Request permission to continue searching. Over."
I exchanged a tense look with Emma.
"Denied, M. Cleaners will sweep the area later. Over." "The boy seems to have some influence over the cleaners. Sweep may not be effective."
cleaners. He must have been talking about the whites, and he was definitely talking about me.
Denied, said the crackling voice. Report back immediately, or you'll spend tonight in the pit. Over.
The white muttered, acknowledged, into his walkie-talkie, and stalked away.
We've got to follow him, Emma said. He could lead us to the others.
And straight into the lion's den, Addison said. Though I suppose that can't be helped.
I was still reeling. They know who I am, I said faintly. They must have seen what I did.
That's right, Emma said, and it scared the stuffing out of them.
I unbent myself to watch the white go. He marched through the crowd, hopped a traffic barricade, and jogged away toward a parked police car. We followed him as far as the traffic barrier. I looked around, trying to imagine the kidnapper's next move. Behind us was the crowd, and in front, beyond the traffic barrier, cars prowled the block for parking. Maybe our friends came this far on foot, I said, then were put into a car. Brightening, Addison stood on hind legs to peek over the traffic barrier.
Yes, that must be it. Bright boy!
What are you so cheerful for? Said Emma. If they were taken away in a car, they could be anywhere by now.
Then we'll follow them anywhere, Addison said pointedly. Though I doubt they're terribly far. My old master had a townhouse not far from here, and I know this part of the city well. There are no major ports nor obvious points of exit from London nearby, but there are a few loop entrances. It's much more likely that they've been taken to one of those. Now, lift me up!
I did, and with my help he scrambled over the barrier and began to sniff around the other side. Within seconds, he'd found our friend's scent trail again.
This way, he said,
pointing down the street after the white, who'd gotten into the police car and was driving away. Looks like we're in for a walk, I said to Emma. Think you can make it?
I'll manage, she said. So long as we find another loop within a few hours. Otherwise I may start sprouting grey hairs and crow's feet.
She smiled, as if this were something to joke about. I won't let that happen, I said. We jumped the barricade. I took one last look at the underground station behind us.
Do you see the hollow? Said Emma.
No. I don't know where it is. And that worries me.
Let's worry about one thing at a time, she said.
We walked as fast as Emma could manage, keeping to the side of the street still sunk in morning shadow, watching for police and following Addison's nose. We passed into an industrial area near the docks, the River Thames revealing itself darkly between the gaps in warehouses, then into a fancy shopping district where glittering stores were crowned with glassy townhouses. Over their roofs I caught glimpses of the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral, whole again, the sky around it clear and blue. The bombs had all been dropped, and the bombers were long gone, shot down, scrapped, retired into museums where they gathered dust behind ropes, to be gawked at by schoolchildren for whom that war seemed as distant as the Crusades. To me it was, quite literally, yesterday. Hard to believe these were the same cratered, blacked-out streets through which we'd run for our lives only last night. They were unrecognizable now, shopping malls seemingly conjured from the ashes, and so were the people who walked them, heads down, glued to phones, clothed in logos. The present seemed suddenly strange to me, so trivial and distracted. I felt like one of those mythical heroes who fights his way back from the underworld, only to realize that the world above is every bit as damned as the one below. and then it hit me. I was back. I was in the present again, and I'd crossed into it without the intervention of Miss Peregrine, which was supposed to be impossible. "Emma," I said, "how did I get here?" She kept her eyes trained on the street ahead, always scanning for trouble.
"Where, London? On a train, silly?"
"No," I lowered my voice. "I mean, to now. You said Miss Peregrine was the only one who could send me back." She turned to glance at me, eyes narrowing.
"Yes," she said slowly. "She was."
"Or so you thought."
"No, she was. I'm sure of it. That's how it works."
"Then how did I get here?" She looked lost.
"I don't know, Jacob. Maybe..."
"There!"
Addison said excitedly, and we broke off wondering to look. His body was rigid, pointing down the street we'd just turned onto.
"I'm picking up dozens of peculiar scent trails now. Dozens upon dozens! And they're fresh!"
"Which means what?" I said.
"Other kidnapped peculiars were brought this way, not just our friends," said Emma. "The White's hideout must be close by."
"Close by here?" I said. The block was lined with fast food joints and tacky souvenir shops, and we stood framed in the neon-lit window of a greasy diner. I guess I'd been imagining some place eviler.
"Like a dungeon in some dank castle," Emma said, nodding.
"Or a concentration camp surrounded by guards and barbed wire fences," I said.
"In the snow, like Horace's drawing."
"We may find such a place yet," said Addison. "Remember, this is likely just the entrance to a loop."
Across the street, tourists were taking pictures of themselves in front of one of the city's iconic red phone boxes. Then they noticed us and snapped a picture in our direction.
"Hey!"
Emma said.
"No photos!"
People were beginning to stare. No longer surrounded by comic conventioneers, we stuck out like sore, bloody thumbs.
"Follow me,"
Addison hissed.
"All the trails lead this way."
We hurried after him down the block. "If only Millard were here," I said. "He could scout this place without being noticed."
"Or if Horace were here, he might remember a dream that would help us," Emma said.
"Or find us new clothes," I added.
"If we don't stop, I'll cry," Emma said.
We came to a jetty bustling with activity. Sun glinted off the water, a narrow inlet of the murky Thames, and clumps of tourists in visors and fanny packs waddled onto and off of several large boats, each offering more or less identical sightseeing tours of London. Addison stopped.
"They were brought here," he said. "It would appear they were put onto a boat."
We followed his nose through the crowd to an empty boat slip. The Whites had indeed loaded our friends onto a boat, and now we needed to follow them. But in what? We walked around the jetty looking for a ride.
"This will never do," Emma grumbled. "These boats are too large and crowded. We need a small one, something we can pilot ourselves."
"Wait a moment,"
said Addison, his snout twitching. He trotted away, nose to the wooden boards. We followed him across the jetty and down a little unmarked ramp that was ignored by the tourists. It led to a lower dock, below the street, just at water level. There was no one around. It was deserted. Here Addison stopped, wearing a look of deep concentration.
"Peculiars have come this way."
"Our peculiars?"
Emma said. He sniffed the dock again and shook his head.
"Not ours,
but there are many trails here, new and old, strong and faded, all mixed together. This is an oft-used pathway.
Ahead of us, the dock narrowed and disappeared beneath the main jetty, where it was swallowed in shadows.
"Oft-used by whom?" Emma said, peering anxiously into the dark. "I've never heard of any loop entrance underneath the dock in Wapping."
Addison had no answer. There was nothing to do but forge on and explore, so we did, passing nervously into the shadows. As our eyes adjusted, another jetty resolved into view, one altogether different from the sunny, pleasant one above us. The boards down here were green and rotting, broken in places. A scrum of squeaking rats scampered through a mound of discarded cans, then leapt a short distance from the dock into an ancient-looking skiff, bobbing in the dark water between wooden pylons slimed with moss.
"Well," Emma said, "I guess that would do in a pinch."
"But it's filled with rats," said Addison, aghast.
"It won't be for long," Emma said,
igniting a small flame in her hand.
"Rats don't much care for my company."
Since there didn't seem to be anyone to stop us, we crossed to the boat, hopscotching around the weakest-looking boards, and began to untie it from the dock.
"Stop!"
came a booming voice from inside the boat. Emma squealed, Addison yelped, and I nearly leapt out of my skin. A man who'd been sitting in the boat, how had we not seen him until now, rose slowly to his feet, straightening himself inch by inch until he towered over us. He was 7 feet tall at least, his massive frame draped in a cloak and his face hidden beneath a dark hood.
I'm so sorry," Emma stammered. "We thought this boat was..."
"Many have tried to steal from Sharon,"
the man thundered.
"Now their skulls make homes for sea creatures."
"I swear we weren't trying to..."
"We'll just be going," squeaked Addison, backing away. "So sorry to bother you, my lord."
"Silence!"
the boatman roared, stepping on to the creaking dock with one enormous stride.
"Anyone who comes for my boat must pay the price."
I was completely terrified, and when Emma shouted, "Run!" I was already turning to go. We'd only gotten a few paces, though, when my foot crashed through a rotting board and I pitched face first onto the dock. I tried to scramble up, but my leg was thigh deep in the hole. I was stuck, and by the time Emma and Addison circled back to help me, it was too late. The boatman was upon us, looming overhead and laughing, his cavernous guffaws booming around us. It might have been a trick of the darkness, but I could have sworn I saw a rat tumble from the hood of his cloak, and another slip from his sleeve as he slowly raised his arm toward us.
"Get away from us, you maniac!"
Emma shouted, clapping her hands to light a flame. Though the light she made did nothing to chase away the dark inside the boatman's hood, I suspected not even the sun could do that. It showed us what he held in his outstretched hand, which wasn't a knife nor any weapon. It was a piece of paper, pinched between his thumb and a long, white forefinger. He was offering it to me, bending low so I could reach it.
"Please," he said calmly, "read it."
I hesitated.
"What is it?"
"The price, and some other information regarding my services."
Quaking with fear, I reached up and took the paper. We all leaned in to read by the light of Emma's flame. "It's the destination, not the journey. Sharon's River Tours, offering day trips and romantic sunset cruises since 1693.
Price, 1 gold piece. Discretion guaranteed. Ask about our specials. I looked up at the giant boatman. So, this is you? I said uncertainly. You're Sharon?
In the flesh,
he replied, his voice an oily slither that made my neck hairs stand on end.
Good bird, man, you scared us half to death, said Addison. Was all that bluster and cackling really necessary?
My apologies. I was napping, and you startled me.
We startled you?
For a moment, I thought you really were trying to steal my boat, he chuckled.
Ha ha, Emma said, forcing a laugh. No, we were just making sure it was moored properly.
Sharon turned to examine the skiff, which was simply roped to one of the wooden pylons.
And how do you find it?
He asked, the dull white crescent of a grin spreading beneath his hood. Totally shipshape, I said, finally jimmying my leg free from the hole. Really good, mooring.
Couldn't have tied a better knot myself, said Emma, helping me to my feet.
By the way, said Addison, the ones who did try, are they really all...
He glanced at the dark water and swallowed audibly.
Never mind that, the boatman said. Now you've woken me, and I am at your service. What can I do for you?
We need to hire your boat, Emma said firmly. By ourselves.
I can't allow that, Sharon said. I always captain the boat.
Ah, too bad then,
Addison said, turning eagerly to leave. Emma caught him by the collar.
Wait, she hissed. We're not done here.
She smiled pleasantly at the boatman.
So, we happen to know that a lot of peculiars come through this...
She looked around, searching for the right word.
Place? Is that because there's a loop entrance nearby?
I don't know what you mean,
Sharon said flatly.
Okay, yes, of course you can't just admit it. I completely understand. But you're in safe company with us. Obviously, we're...
I elbowed her.
Emma, don't! Why not? He's already seen the dog talk and me make fire. If we can't speak honestly...
But we don't know if he is, I said.
Of course he is, she said, then turned to Sharon. You are, aren't you?
The boatman stared at us impassively.
He is, isn't he?
Emma asked Addison.
Can't you smell it on him?
No, not clearly.
Well, I suppose it doesn't matter, so long as he's not a white.
She gave Sharon a beady-eyed glare.
You're not, are you?
I am a businessman,
he said evenly,
who's well accustomed to meeting talking dogs and girls who make fire with their hands, said Addison.
In my line of work, one meets a wide variety of people.
I'll cut to the chase, I said, shaking water off one foot, then the other. We're looking for some friends of ours. We think they might have come this way within the last hour or so. Mostly kids, some adults. One was invisible, one could float.
They'd be hard to miss, Emma said. They were being held at gunpoint by a gang of whites.
Sharon crossed his arms into a wide, black X.
As I said, all manner of people hire my boat, and each relies on my absolute discretion. I won't discuss my clientele.
Is that so? Emma said. Excuse us just a moment.
She took me aside to whisper in my ear.
If he doesn't start talking, I'm going to get really angry.
Don't do anything reckless, I whispered back.
Why? You believe that humbug about skulls and sea creatures?
Yes, actually. I know he's a slime bag, but...
Slime bag? He's practically admitted to doing business with whites. He might even be one.
But he's a useful slime bag. I have a feeling he knows exactly where our friends were taken. It's just a matter of asking the right questions.
Then have at it, she said crossly.
I turned to Sharon and said with a smile, What can you tell me about your tours? He brightened immediately.
Finally, a subject I can speak freely about. I just happen to have some information right here.
He turned snappily and went to a nearby pylon. A shelf had been nailed onto it, and upon the shelf was displayed a skull dressed in old-time aviator garb, leather cap, goggles, a jaunty scarf. Gripped between its teeth were several pamphlets, and Sharon pulled one out and handed it to me. It was a cheesy tourist brochure that looked like it had been printed when my grandfather was a boy. I leafed through its pages as Sharon cleared his throat and spoke.
Let's see now. Families enjoy the Famine and Flames package. In the morning we go upriver to watch Viking siege engines catapult diseased sheep over the city walls, then have a nice boxed lunch and return in the evening via the Great Fire of 1666, which is a real treat after dark, with the flames reflecting on the water, very nice. Or if you've only a few hours to spare, we have a lovely gibbeting round Execution Dock, right at sunset, popular with honeymooners, in which some excellently foul-tongued pirates give colourful speeches before being put to the rope. For a small fee, you can even have your photo taken with them.
Inside the brochure were illustrations of smiling tourists enjoying the sights he'd described. The final page was a photo of one of Sharon's guests posing with a gang of surly pirates wielding knives and guns. Peculiars do this stuff for fun? I marveled.
This is a waste of time.
Emma whispered, checking behind us anxiously.
I'll bet he's just running out the clock until the next patrol of whites arrives.
I don't think so, I said. Just wait.
Sharon was ploughing on as if he hadn't heard us.
And you can see all the lunatics' heads arranged on pikes as we float beneath London Bridge. Lastly, there's our most requested excursion, which is a personal favourite of mine. But, oh... Never mind, he said coyly, waving his hand. Come to think of it, I doubt you'd be interested in Devil's Acre.
Why not? Emma said. Too nice and pleasant.
Actually, it's rather a rough spot. Certainly no place for children.
Emma stamped her foot and shook the whole rotting dock.
That's where our friends were taken, isn't it? She shouted. Isn't it?
Don't lose your temper, miss. Your safety is my highest concern.
Quit winding us up and tell us what's there.
Well, if you insist.
Sharon made a sound like he was slipping into a warm bath and began rubbing his leathery hands together as if just thinking about it brought him pleasure.
Nasty things. He said, dreadful things, vile things, anything you like, so long as what you like is nasty, dreadful and vile. I've often dreamed of hanging up my oar pole and retiring there one day, perhaps to run the little abattoir on Oozing Street.
What name did you call it again? Said Addison.
Devil's Acre.
The boatman said wistfully. Addison shuddered from tip to tail.
I know it, he said gravely. It's a terrible place. the most depraved and dangerous slum in the whole long history of London. I've heard stories of peculiar animals brought there in cages and made to fight in blood sport games. Grim bears pitted against emu rafts, chimpanzees against flamingoes, parents against their own children, forced to maim and kill one another for the entertainment of a few sick peculiars.
Disgusting, Emma said. What peculiar would participate in such a thing?
Addison shook his head ruefully.
Outlaws, mercenaries, exiles.
But there are no outlaws in peculiardom, said Emma. Any peculiar convicted of a crime is brought by the Home Guard to a punishment loop.
How little you know of your own world, the boatman said.
Criminals can't be jailed if they're never caught, Addison explained.
Not if they escape to a loop like that first. Lawless, ungovernable.
It sounds like hell, I said. Why would anyone go there voluntarily?
What's hell for some, said the boatman, is paradise for others. It's the last truly free place. Somewhere you can buy anything, sell anything.
He leaned toward me and lowered his voice.
Or hide anything.
Like kidnapped Imbrins and peculiar children? I said. Is that what you're getting at?
I said nothing of the sort, shrugged the boatman, busying himself with a rat plucked from the hem of his cloak. Shoo there, Percy, Daddy's working.
While he placed the rat gently aside, I gathered Emma and Addison in a tight huddle.
What do you think?
I whispered.
Could this devil place really be where our friends were taken? Well, they have to be keeping their prisoners inside a loop, and a pretty old one, said Emma. Otherwise most of us would age forward and die after a day or two.
But what do the whites care if we die?
I said.
They just want to steal our souls. Maybe, but they can't let the Imbrins die. They need them to recreate the 1908 event. Remember the whites' crazy plan?
All that stuff Golan was raving about. Immortality and ruling the world.
Yeah. So they've been kidnapping Imbrins for months and need a place to hold them where they won't turn into dried fruit leather, right? Which means a pretty old loop. 80, 100 years at least. And if Devil's Acre is really a lawless jungle of depravity...
It is, said Addison.
Then it sounds like a perfect spot for whites to secret away their captives.
Right in the heart of peculiar London, too, said Addison. Right under everyone's noses. Clever little blighters.
Guess that settles it, I said. Emma stepped smartly toward Sharon.
We'll take 3 tickets to that disgusting, horrible place you described, please.
Be very, very certain that's what you want, said the boatman. Innocent lambs like yourselves don't always return from Devil's Acre.
We're sure, I said.
Very good, then. But don't say I didn't warn you.
Only thing is, we don't have 3 gold pieces, said Emma.
Is that right?
Sharon tented his long fingers and let out a sigh that smelt like an opened tomb.
Normally I insist on payment up front, but I'm feeling generous this morning. I find your plucky optimism charming. You can owe me.
And then he laughed, as if he knew we'd never live to repay him, and stepping aside, he raised a cloaked arm toward his boat.
Welcome aboard, children.
Chapter 2 Sharon made a big show of plucking 6 wriggling rats from his boat before we boarded, as if a pestilence-free journey were a luxury afforded only to very important peculiars, and then he offered Emma his arm and helped her step from the dock. We were seated 3 abreast on a simple wooden bench. While Sharon was busy untying the mooring rope, I wondered whether trusting him was merely unwise, or if it crossed the line into recklessness, like lying down for a nap in the middle of a road. The trouble with the merely unwise, deeply stupid line is that you often don't know which side you're on until it's too late. By the time things have settled down enough for you to reflect, the button's been pushed, the plane's left the hangar, or in our case, the boat's left the dock, and as I watched Sharon shove us away from it with his foot, which was bare, and I noticed that his bare foot was not quite human-looking, with toes as long as mini hot dogs and thick yellow nails that curled like claws, I realized with sinking certainty which side of the line we were on, and also that it was too late to do much about it. Sharon yanked the ignition cord on a dinky outboard motor, and it coughed awake in a cloud of blue fumes. Tucking his considerable legs beneath him, he lowered into the puddle of black fabric his cloak made in the boat. He revved the puttering engine, then steered us out of the underjetty, through a forest of looming wood pylons, and into warm sunlight. Then we were in a canal, a man-made tributary of the Thames, walled on both sides by glassy buildings, and bobbing with more boats than a toddler's tub at bath time, candy-red tugs and wide flat barges, and tour boats whose upper decks teemed with sightseers taking the air. Strangely, none of them trained their cameras at, nor seemed to even notice, the unusual craft that burbled past them, with an angel of death at the tiller, 2 blood-spattered children in the seat, and a dog in glasses peering over the side. Which was just as well. Had Sharon charmed his boat somehow so that only peculiars could see it? I decided to believe it was so, because there was nowhere to hide in it anyway, should we have needed to. Looking it over in the full light of day, I noticed that the boat was extremely simple, but for an intricately carved figurehead rising from its bow. The carving was shaped like a fat, scaly snake that curved upward in a gentle S, but where a head should have been was a giant eyeball, lidless and large as a melon, staring forever out before us. "What is it?" I asked, running my hand over its polished surface.
"You would,"
Sharon called over the motor's growl.
"I would what?"
"That's what it's made from."
"But what's it for?"
"To see with,"
he replied testily. Sharon pushed the motor harder, possibly just to drown out my questions, and as we picked up speed, the bow lifted gently from the water. I took a deep breath, enjoying the sun and wind on my face, and Addison let his tongue hang out as he leaned over the side with his paws, looking as happy as I'd ever seen him. What a beautiful day to go to hell.
"So I've been thinking about how you got here," Emma said. "How you got back to the present."
"Okay," I said. "What do you think?"
"There's only one explanation that makes any sense, though not bloody much. When we were in the underground tunnels with all those whites, and we crossed back into the present, the reason you came with us instead of continuing on in 18-whatever it was, suddenly alone, was that Miss Peregrine was there somehow, nearby, and helped you cross without anyone knowing it."
"I don't know, Emma. That seems..." I hesitated, not wanting to be harsh.
You think she was hiding in the tunnel?
I'm saying it's possible. We've no idea where she was.
The Whites have her. Call admitted it.
Since when do you believe anything the Whites say?
You've got me there, I said. But since Call was boasting about having her, I figured he was probably telling the truth.
Maybe. Or he said it to crush our spirits and make us want to give up. He was trying to convince us to surrender to his soldiers, remember?
True, I said, frowning. My brain was starting to kink from all the possibilities. Okay, let's say for the sake of argument that Miss P was with us in the tunnel. Why would she have gone to the trouble of sending me back to the present as a captive of the Whites? We were on our way to have our second souls sucked out. I would have been better off stuck in that loop. For a moment, Emma looked genuinely stumped. Then her face lit up and she said, "Unless you and I are supposed to rescue everyone else. Maybe it was all part of her plan."
But how could she have known we would escape the Whites?
Emma cast a sidelong glance at Addison.
"Maybe she had help," she whispered.
"Em, this hypothetical chain of events is getting really unlikely." I took a breath, choosing my words carefully. "I know you want to believe Miss Peregrine is out there somewhere, free, watching over us. I do, too."
"I want that so badly it hurts," she said.
"But if she were free, wouldn't she have contacted us somehow?"
"And if he were involved," I said quietly, nodding toward Addison, "wouldn't he have mentioned it by now?" "Not if he's sworn to secrecy. Perhaps it's too dangerous to tell anyone, even us. If we knew Miss Peregrine's whereabouts, and someone knew we knew, we might break under torture."
"And he wouldn't?" I said a little too loudly, and the dog looked up at us, his cheeks ballooning and tongue flapping ridiculously as the wind caught them.
"Ho there!"
he cried. "I've counted 56 fish already, though one or two might have been bits of half-submerged rubbish. What are you two whispering about?"
"Oh, nothing," said Emma.
"Somehow I doubt that," he muttered,
but his suspicion was quickly overwhelmed by his instincts, and a second later he yelped,
"Fish!"
And his attention lasered back to the water.
"Fish! Fish! Rubbish! Fish!"
Emma laughed darkly.
"It's a completely mad idea, I know, but my brain is a hope-making engine."
"I'm so glad," I said. "Mine is a worst-case scenario generator."
"We need each other, then?"
"Yes, but we already knew that, I think." The boat's steady heaving pushed us together and apart, together and apart.
"Sure you wouldn't rather go on the romantic cruise?" Sharon said. "It isn't too late."
"Very sure," I said. "We're on a mission."
"Then I suggest you open the box you're sitting on. You're going to need what's inside when we cross over."
We opened the bench's hinged top to find a large canvas tarp.
"What's this for?" I said.
"Cowering beneath,"
Sharon replied, and he turned the boat down an even narrower canal lined with new, expensive-looking condos.
"I've been able to keep you hidden from view thus far, but the protection I can offer doesn't work inside the acre. And unsavory characters tend to keep watch for easy prey round the entrance. And you are most certainly easy prey."
"I knew you were up to something," I said. "Not a single tourist so much as glanced at us."
It's safer to watch historical atrocities being committed when the participants aren't able to watch you back, he said. Can't have my customers being carried off by Viking raiders, can I? Imagine the user reviews.
We were fast approaching a sort of tunnel, a bridged-over stretch of canal, perhaps 100 feet long, atop which hulked a building like a warehouse or an old mill. From the far end shone a half-circle of blue sky and sparkling water. Between here and there was only darkness. It looked as much like a loop entrance as any place I'd seen. We heaved out the enormous tarp, which filled half the boat. Emma lay down beside me and we wriggled beneath it, drawing the edge up to our chins like bedsheets. As the boat glided beneath the bridge into shadow, Sharon cut the motor and hid it beneath another, smaller tarp. Then he stood and extended a collapsible staff, plunged it into the water until it touched bottom, and began poling us forward in long, silent strokes.
"By the way," Emma said, "what sort of unsavory characters are we hiding from? Whites?"
"There's more evil in peculiardom than merely your hated whites," Sharon said, his voice echoing through the stone tunnel. "An opportunist disguised as a friend can be every bit as dangerous as an outright enemy."
Emma sighed.
"Must you always be so vague?"
"Your heads!" he snapped. "You too, dog!"
Addison snuffled beneath the tarp, and we pulled the edge over our faces. It was black and hot under the fabric, and it smelled overpoweringly of motor oil.
"Are you frightened?"
Addison whispered in the dark.
"Not particularly," said Emma. "Are you, Jacob?"
"So much I might throw up."
"Addison?"
"Of course not,"
the dog said.
"Fearfulness isn't a characteristic of my breed."
But then he snuggled right between Emma and me, and I could feel his whole body trembling. Some changeovers are as fast and smooth as superhighways, but this one felt like slamming down a washboard road full of potholes, lurching around a hairpin turn, and then careening off a cliff, all in complete darkness. When it was finally over, my head was dizzy and pounding. I wondered what invisible mechanism made some changeovers harder than others. Maybe the journey was only as rough as the destination, and this one had felt like off-roading into a savage wilderness, because that's precisely what we had done.
"You've arrived,"
Sharon announced.
"Is everyone okay?"
I said, fumbling for Emma's hand.
"We must go back,"
Addison groaned.
"I've left my kidneys on the other side."
"Do keep quiet until I find somewhere discreet to deposit you," Sharon said.
It's amazing how much more acute your hearing becomes the moment you can't use your eyes. As I lay quietly beneath the tarp, I was hypnotized by the sounds of a bygone world blooming around us. At first, there was only the splash of Sharon's pole in the water, but soon it was complemented by other noises, all stirring together to paint an elaborate scene in my mind. That steady slap of wood against water belonged, I imagined, to the oars of a passing boat, piled high with fish. I pictured the ladies I could hear shouting to one another as leaning from the windows of opposite-facing houses, trading gossip across the canal while tending lines of laundry. Ahead of us, children whooped with laughter as a dog barked, and distantly I could make out voices singing in time to the rhythm of hammers. "Hark to the clinging of hammers! Hark to the driving of nails!" Before long, I was imagining plucky chimney sweeps in top hats, skipping down streets full of rough charm and people banding together to overcome their lot in life with a wink and a song.